Nothing out of the ordinary. Here is VOA correspondent Phil Mercer.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says Assange, who was born in the Queensland city of Townsville, will get no special treatment.
We support Australians in those cases by providing that consular assistance. So Mr. Assange will get the same support that any other Australian would in these circumstances. He's not going to be given any special treatment. He'll get the same treatment as everybody else. He'll get the same support as everyone else.
Campaigners in Australia consider Assange's arrest and possible extradition to Sweden or the US as a threat to investigative journalism.
Phil Mercer of VOA filed that report. To stay on top of all the day's news, we invite you online to voanews.com. You can also use the convenient VOA News app. This is VOA News. Sudan's intelligence chief resigned today, one day after the defense minister quit following the military's overthrow of the civilian government. The defense minister, General Awad Mohamed Ahmed Ibn Auf, stepped down Friday as the head of the Transitional Military Council after serving only one day in that position. He made the announcement as demonstrators in the streets of Khartoum called for a faster end to autocratic rule and worsening economic conditions. Malta's prime minister has announced on Twitter that four European Union countries, Germany, France, Portugal, and Luxembourg, will take the 64 migrants who were rescued by a German ship off the coast of Libya 10 days ago and taken to Malta. Those rescued include 10 women, 5 children, and a newborn baby. Syria says an Israeli airstrike on a military site in the central province of Hama has wounded 3 Syrian soldiers. The state news agency says several buildings were destroyed in the early Saturday attack. Israel has launched a number of raids against what it says are Iranian targets in Syria and insists it will not tolerate Iran establishing a presence in Syria near Israel's borders. Here in Washington, the Trump administration has suffered another federal court defeat over immigration. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has a report.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a temporary stay that blocked a ruling that told the Trump administration it couldn't send the migrants back into Mexico to await their asylum hearings because the policy failed to evaluate the dangers these people face in Mexico. The government appealed, saying Judge Richard Seaborg's ruling was erroneous and it endangers the public during a humanitarian crisis at the border. The original injunction was sought by civil rights groups who are suing to change the policy. The lawsuit and the appeals process could take months. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Along with massive protests, Algeria is also facing serious economic problems, which has helped to drive the current unrest. While the North African country is rich in oil and gas, it has failed to diversify its economy, and unemployment is high. For VOA, here is Lisa Bryant.
Another Friday, another mass protest in Algeria. Once again, thousands of people took to the streets calling for the country's leadership to go. Although there were reports of clashes and arrests this time, the largely peaceful demonstrations that began in February show Algerians want a complete overhaul of a political system that has been in place since independence. But the protests are also about the economy.
The economy is not in a very good shape, obviously.
Alexandre Kateb is a Paris-based analyst and served as an economic advisor for a recent former Algerian prime minister, Abdelmalek Sellal.
The protest is, as you might say, the last straw on the back of the camel.
Lisa Bryan, reporting for VOA, filed that report. For more news, you can go online to voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News, Washington.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, sitting in for Peter Clotier.
Calculation from the military that just removing Bashir is sufficient. I think the initial reactions are that no, I think they've miscalculated and that the protests are going to demand more change than just simply removing al-Bashir.
Protesters in Sudan demand immediate move to civilian rule just days after the overthrow of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir.
Vaccination is proving to be a highly effective way of stopping this virus, but if we can't vaccinate people, we can't protect them. We can also not get people out to Ebola treatment units. If someone stays in the community with Ebola and begins to have diarrhea or bleeding, they will infect their families.
Experts at the World Health Organization say Ebola in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo does not constitute a public health emergency of international concern.
Amid the ongoing clashes, IOM staff in Libya coordinated very closely with Libyan authorities to ensure the safe arrival of all migrants coming from different detention centers in different urban areas in Tripoli to Matiga Airport.
And the International Organization for Migration successfully returns 160 migrants to Mali. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Amid continuing turmoil and ongoing protests in Sudan following the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir after 30 years in power, the country's new military ruler has resigned. This comes as the Transitional Military Council plans to restore civilian rule, ideally within 2 years. But the United States is calling on Sudan's military leaders to hand over power to civilians sooner. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sine reports from the State Department.
Protesters in Khartoum defied a Thursday night curfew in Sudan, demanding civilians replace the military leaders now in charge. The Sudanese army forced out the country's autocratic president, Omar al-Bashir, after months of escalating protests against his longtime rule. On Friday, the chief of the political wing of Sudan's Transitional Military Council says they will not extradite Bashir, who faces charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide for his deadly campaign against insurgents in Darfur. Leaders vow that their military rule is temporary. Colonel General Omar Zain al-Abidin of the Transitional Military Council.
But if it becomes clear to us that within a month, Sudan is able to manage things without chaos breaking out, then we are prepared to do this, even if it is just a month.
A Sudanese activist tells VOA Bashir cultivated a false narrative that he was necessary for stability in the country. Nimat Ahmadi of the Darfur Women Action Group.
Bashir is the worst to rule the Sudan, and Sudan has so many civilians who are qualified to lead the people. And it is not about who to lead, but how people want to be led.
The U.S. commended the people of Sudan for their resiliency and peaceful protest. But Deputy Secretary Robert Paladino declined to answer if the U.S. considers the military takeover a coup. Robert Paladino, Deputy State Department spokesman.
It's a historic moment for the people of Sudan. The
we know
Sudanese
that, but
people
do you consider it
have clearly voiced their opinion, and we continue to monitor the situation there. It remains fluid. At this time, we don't have a final assessment.
Amid street celebrations in Khartoum, the State Department says the U.S. wants a return to civilian rule in Sudan in less than 2 years. Cindy Sane, VOA News, the State Department.
Meanwhile, Sudan popular uprising in Sudan achieved one of its major objectives, which is removing the 30-year-long President Omar al-Bashir. But protesters have rejected the transition roadmap offered by the defense minister, who apparently abruptly resigned Friday. Opposition leaders insist on a civilian transitional government. Saeed Sadek, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi about who are the major groups that led the Sudanese popular uprising and the significance of the reemergence of former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi in the political scene after years of exile in London.
We have been seeing the tensions build in Sudan for some time, and so we have been expecting something to break one way or the other. And so it appears the military has decided to try and proactively take control of the situation and remove al-Bashir, who is highly unpopular. And for now, it appears they are hoping to be able to maintain control themselves. I think they are calculating that by removing Bashir, they will be meeting the principal demands of the protesters, and that then they will be in a position to manage the transition moving forward.
But some opposition figures are fearing that Sudan is adopting the Egyptian model again.
Well, I think this is the risk. And it is notable that almost immediately many of the protest leaders have rejected the calls by the military to create this two-year military council. So they're not accepting that way forward. And instead, they are calling for a civilian-led interim transitional council. And they are continuing to mount protest. And in fact, I understand protests are expanding. So I think the question that we're going to have to watch is whether the calculation from the military that just removing Bashir is sufficient. I think the initial reactions are that no, I think they've miscalculated, and that the protests are going to demand more change than just simply removing al-Bashir.
But with the announcement of a curfew, how could the protesters continue their gathering while they are banned from being in the street during the night?
I think we're going to have to see how this plays out, because there has already been a state of emergency, but protesters have continued to express themselves and come out onto the streets. And I don't see that they're going to stop that now. I think the military also has to be careful, because if they resort to more heavy-handed violence, they're going to build up even more animosity on the part of the general population. We've seen some violence already from the security forces in the previous weeks during the earlier protest, but it has been somewhat restrained. Moreover, in the last week, we've seen some elements of the military and the police protecting protesters. So I don't think the security services are unified in how they are approaching this. And I think they need to be careful if they hope to retain some influence in the transition moving forward, that they continue to manage the support of the population. And I should say that I think because of the protection that some in the security services have provided the protesters, that I think there is a room for dialogue here between the military and the protest leaders. And I think there is an opportunity for them to work out some sort of cooperative arrangement for this transitional period that will lead to some sort of more representative system.
That was Saeed Sadek, a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi from the Egyptian capital. This month, Rwanda marks 25 years since the genocide that followed the downing of the president's airplane. At the United Nations, the international community paused Friday to commemorate the genocide and pay tribute to both the dead and the survivors. VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir, has more.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, along with two survivors, lit candles in the General Assembly Hall. The UN chief said there are lessons to be learned from that dark moment in history.
We must take a hard look at the present. As we renew our resolve to prevent such atrocities from ever happening again, we are seeing dangerous trends of rising xenophobia, racism, and intolerance in many parts of the world. Particularly troubling is the current widespread proliferation of hate speech and incitement to violence.
During the 1994 genocide, massacres were often preceded by hate-filled speeches or radio broadcasts inciting violence. President Kagame said the act of remembrance also is an act of prevention.
When genocide is dormant, it takes the form of denial and trivialization. Denial is an ideological foundation of genocide. Countering denial and trivialization. Denial is an ideological foundation of genocide. Countering denial is essential for breaking the cycle and preventing any recurrence.
He said efforts to rewrite the history of the genocide are relentless and increasingly mainstream. The genocide is a stain on the history of the United Nations, which failed to act when warned it was imminent and pulled back peacekeepers as the situation escalated. But the main message of Friday's commemoration was reconciliation and resilience. Marcel Weneza lost his father, two brothers, a sister, and other relatives. He barely survived himself. Today, he is a Jesuit Catholic priest.
Later, I met the killer of my two brothers and my sister, and when I saw him, I thought he was coming to kill me. As if in a movie, he knelt before me and asked to forgive him. I took him, embraced him, and when finally I said, "I forgive you," I felt free.
Survivor Esther Mujawayo Kiner said Rwandan society had to be reconstructed after the genocide because it had been completely broken. And Rwandans have succeeded. Today, the country has one of the fastest-growing economies in Central Africa. It is a regional leader in environmental sustainability, and more than 60% of its parliament seats are occupied by women. Perhaps most significantly, no one is identified as Tutsi or Hutu. They are all simply Rwandan. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Experts meeting in an emergency session at the World Health Organization agree the Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo does not constitute a public health emergency of international concern. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The experts say the Ebola outbreak does not pose a global threat since the deadly virus has not crossed any international borders. But they warn this is no time to relax as the epidemic continues to spread. It says efforts to contain the disease must be redoubled. A recent spike in Ebola infections has seen the number of cases rise to 1,206, including 764 deaths. The current upsurge has occurred in remaining epicenters of the disease in conflict-ridden North Kivu, notably Butembo, Katwa, Vuhove, and Mandima. The World Health Organization says these areas have been off-limits because of insecurity, seriously hindering the Ebola response. Because of the lack of access, Executive Director of WHO Health Emergency Program, Mike Ryan, says WHO has fallen behind in starting vaccination rings.
Vaccination is proving to be a highly effective way of stopping this virus, but if we can't vaccinate people, we can't protect them. We can also not get people out to Ebola treatment units. If someone stays in the community with Ebola and begins to have diarrhea or bleeding, they will infect their families. So getting an Ebola patient to safe and effective treatment center is also very important.
In the last few days, Ryan says aid workers have been able to get back into these Ebola-affected communities. He says they've been able to begin vaccinations and implement other crucial Ebola control measures. The current Ebola outbreak is the worst ever in DRC and the second largest recorded after the 2014 epidemic in West Africa, which killed more than 11,000 people. The WHO expert committee recommends scaling up community dialogue and participation of traditional healers to lessen community mistrust and gain its acceptance. Because of the high risk of regional spread, the committee advises neighboring countries to accelerate current preparedness and surveillance efforts. The World Health Organization is appealing to the international community to support its Ebola control operation. It says it desperately needs $148 million to keep the operation running until July. It warns it will not be able to end the epidemic if it does not have the money to implement essential programs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigeria's 2019 election has gone from the polling booth to the courtroom, where the People's Democratic Party, PDP, the main opposition party, is challenging the re-election of President Muhammadu Buhari. Reporter Gift Agriga from Abuja, Nigeria, tells us more.
The People's Democratic Party charges widespread voter fraud in February's presidential and National Assembly elections. The main opposition party and the ruling APC party both are accused of massive vote buying, rigging, violence. There also are accusations that the country's electoral body, the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, acted for and against the ruling party. Now, the main opposition, PDP, has declared the results fraudulent and pledged to seek legal redress. Eseme Eyibo is a chieftain in the ruling APC party. He says it's appropriate for anyone who feels aggrieved to head to court. But, he said, Buhari's victory was expected.
It's not just picking and going to court. For example, the presidential election, it wouldn't have been possible for Tiku to have won that election because two things qualify the winner of the election in this country by our law: the issue of the majority votes and the issue of spread. So there's no way Tiku would have had more spread than Buhari, and there's no way Tiku would have had more electoral votes than Buhari.
In addition, the ruling APC party has accused the PDP of hacking into the server of the Independent National Electoral Commission. The APC was upset when opposition supporters claimed that numbers from the servers of the Electoral Commission showed that Atiku had won by about 1.6 million votes. The claim was presented in the petition Atiku and his party filed to challenge the election results. The ruling APC now is wondering how the PDP could have found the numbers without hacking into the computers of the Electoral Commission. The APC claimed that after the postponement of the February 16 presidential and National Assembly elections, results for the presidential elections surfaced on the internet. Kayode Ajulu, a constitutional lawyer, warns that hacking the INEC server is an act of terrorism and amounts to a crime.
For anybody to even tamper with it alone, irrespective of whatever you call it, a crime has been committed. How SOG will be dealt with is another thing. Section 84 really explains how it could be done. You must be authorized. That is the first thing.
In the court case between the PDP presidential candidate Atiku Abubakar and President Buhari, Ajulu said that the president will not be incapacitated from doing his duties while the trial lasts. Meanwhile, the National Publicity Secretary of the People's Democratic Party, Kola Olobonion, says the 2019 election was a sham and that its candidate won.
The people did a new government. I will present a candidate that they believed in. So it's mistakes for anybody to say that, where would you do? We'll do a post-mortem, I will come to the world. We'll treat every election on its merit and its demerit.
Although a majority of local and international observers have judged the election to be fair, what transpired during the vote highlights the challenges of holding free, fair, and credible elections in Nigeria. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
Meanwhile, in Zambia, the ruling Patriotic Front won 6 out of 11 by-elections this week, but the party lost the Roan parliamentary constituency, one of its strongholds in the mainly mining town. Supporters of the ruling party, Patriotic Front, PF, say the loss was self-inflicted because leaders of the governing group failed to listen to them. They warned that the victory of the opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC, is a strong indication of things to come in the 2021 general election. The defeat led President Edgar Lungu to call for a serious party introspection. For more about the recently held by-election, VOA's Peter Klote reached Sande Chanda, media director for the Zambian ruling Patriotic Front Party.
The Patriotic Front is very strong, and as you know, that of the seats that we have continued to win and in recent by-elections, these are seats in formerly UPND strongholds. We won one seat in Western Province, which was the UPND seat. We won another seat in Central Province, which was a UPND seat. We won another seat in Northwestern Province, which is a UPND stronghold. And so for us, we are winning new grounds, and we feel very confident, and the people of Zambia have continued to embrace the Party Front's message of development.
But Sunday, the party lost at one of its main strongholds in Roan. What happened?
The Roan constituency, the vote purely a protest vote. For the simple reason that there have been issues in Roan constituency. As you know, this is a mining town. The problems that are there are problems dating from the days of the privatization when the Luansha Mining Company was sold to Ramcos, and there were people that were not paid and miners who have not been paid to date. And this is one of the thorny issues in the constituency that came to haunt us. Our people in Roan constituency felt that we've not been able to attend to this particular problem. Now, you know, to understand, Roan, by many accounts, has always been a renegade seat.
But some people are saying the defeat could also be attributed to the way the PF particularly treated or mistreated Chisemba Kambwili, who was a founding member of the party, who has since been kicked out of the party, who they said allegedly the government plotted to remove him from parliament by using all kinds of means by which these by-elections took place, and that you did not even listen to the people who were crying out for help. How do you react to that?
You know very well that on his own, Mr. Kambwili and his party, the NDC, weren't going to win their own seat. They didn't have the capacity to win their own seat. But what we saw happen, of course, was that the opposition, UPND, did not field a candidate for Roan, and they decided to go and campaign for the NDC candidate. The UPND backed, you know, NDC candidate in Roan constituency. So standing on his own, as Chisemba Kambwili and his party, they weren't going to win the election yesterday. And so those who say that this is about, you know, PF being made to pay for how they treated Chisemba Kambwili is neither here nor there. This is an issue. This is a protest vote. The protest vote is hinging on the mining issues, historical, that exist in Roan constituency. And this has been made very, very clear that the miners and ex-miners still feel that we have not attended to their issues adequately.
But there are also issues that you did not listen to your supporters on the ground, and that this is a sign of things to come, and that is why they said the president himself called for an introspection within the ruling PF itself.
Of course, there are issues to do with whether or not we picked the right candidate for Roan. Those issues are coming up. Of course, those are in-house issues. Whether or not the person we adopted was the right person to stand on the PF ticket, or we could have fit on the provincial chairperson for Cobre Belt Province, who is also mayor for Luansha, Nathan Chanda, who's had, basically, I mean, everybody believed that Roan constituency after Chisemba Kambwili would go to Nathan Chanda. And so there are all these in-house issues. And whether or not we listened to what the people really wanted.
So what are the major takeaways of these by-elections, if I may ask you briefly?
Well, Well, the major takeaways are that, number one, we need to resolve the mining issues, the issues coming, I mean, arising from the privatization of the 1990s, RAMCOs, people have not been paid to date. Some of the ex-miners, we were able to give them land. The issue has been around processing their titles and giving them the kind of support so that they embark on new livelihood into the farming sector. And these are issues, and of course some of the issues have to do with new mine owners and how they are treating suppliers. So by and large, this is an issue that has to do with the economic welfare of our people. And there's a political will from the president directing the Minister of Mines that these issues ought to be resolved. The issues of casual workers and our people being mistreated by new mine owners, those are real issues in the wrong constituency. And we are not going to rest until these issues are attended to.
That was Sunday Chanda, media director for the Zambian Ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with my colleague, Peter Clote. This is the Voice of America in Washington, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, the International Organization for Migration has repatriated 160 African migrants who have been living under dire conditions in Libya amid the chaos reigning in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency says it returned these stranded migrants to their homes despite what it calls the extraordinarily difficult conditions on the ground. The situation in and around Tripoli has become increasingly violent and unstable since a renegade general began an offensive April 4th to capture the Libyan capital. Even with this turbulent backdrop, IOM organized a charter flight this week to Mali, carrying 160 migrants. Most will remain in Mali, but 61 migrants from Ivory Coast and Burkina Faso will continue onward to their homes of origin. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says his agency has had to work around the difficulties posed by increased airport security this week. Security has been tightened since the airport was hit by an airstrike. Millman says IOM's chartered plane has had to adjust to the new limited hours of operation.
Amid the ongoing clashes, IOM staff in Libya coordinated very closely with Libyan authorities to ensure the safe arrival of all migrants coming from different detention centers in different urban areas in Tripoli to Matiga Airport. The airport was briefly affected by the armed conflict this week, but later resumed activity, as I said, only between the hours of 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. every day.
So far this year, IOM has repatriated 3,175 migrants from detention centers and urban centers. Millman tells VOA he does not know how the conflict will affect future returns.
Of course, you know, any insecurity that arises from violence or weather or anything else will upset that well-oiled machine. But I guess, reiterate what I said at the beginning, that the fact that we did it now in this climate indicates we intend to do it whenever we can.
Millman says IOM helps the migrants reintegrate in their communities upon their return. Upon arrival, he says they receive immediate assistance and medical screenings. He notes that IOM tailors its reintegration support to the specific needs of returnees. He says the aim is to help them earn a living and become economically self-sufficient within their communities of origin. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And now it's time for a Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
All I need is your love, yeah. Sweet love, baby, yeah. All I need is your love, yeah. Yeah. Baby, get nobody off, you know. Baby girl, nothing consign them. Am I love for away,
pole pole sauti tete usije ntesha nafsi kuku nipe mchele maindinge dere usije nyacha basi paka machoko kitandani ni mafunzo ya kikomando nipe mama nipe nyumba na choo kera umevua pereke bila chambo wanapata kafu wanajona tunapendana Sasambua, kemaleza kupika kazi yangu kupakua Kemaleza kufua kazi yangu kukamua ukitaka mua Na umenya na kugea unakula oh, Uchungu wangu unaujua wewe Uchungu wako na ujua gamimi mwenye Pirika pirika za kukuna mwewe Tuinjo inato wala zisi tusumbu Wanapata kafu, wanajona tunapendana Chukua Umeniweza nyanga nyanga Ayu Nyanga 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 Baby yo Tukateleza nyanga nyanga Umwako nyanga nyanga Besi yo Umeniweza nyanga nyanga
estar numa numa ei, numa numa ei, numa 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 ei, que poder și dragostea din tei, n-amintesc de ochii tăi ei.
Safari ya penzi na wewe sikatishe Mungu mwema baba bali atufikishe mi binadamu nakosea kiteleza usihuzunike milele mwana dada ikifa unizike kutoka kwenye ufungu wa moyo wangu tamka ni wewe taswira pekee kwenye ndoto zangu mama Nishinda siri kifuoni mwangu Nikupeleke nyumbani kwetu sheria Kajue na ndugu zangu mama Unipeleke nyumbani kwenu bibi wewe Nikaole shemeji zangu mama Siri ya nini Nini manake Siri ya nini
kamka usingizi sikampa katuki amka ni sirizi kakonko twende kamara kibirizi mapaja yake utamu michirizi michepuko imenuna imezira sili sili na weni kachumbari mayonnaise pili 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 manga kuna kili kili wanga kili manjaro nyumbani kwetu kisimili mwanga si mama niki si mama wima siri nikilele nikufikishe kwa kina umebeba beba mkungu wa muleba uchungu kama kwao wakajifungue leba umebeba beba mkungu wa muleba uchungu kama kwao wakajifungue leba
oh mama lord mama lord kwa kosi kiwezi
oh mama lord
sitoficha mdudu mapenzi
oh mama lord
mama lord kwa kosi kiwezi
oh mama lord
mama lord
kwenye kamoyo misina
siri
jeni kutaje kajina
siri
ajue wenye fitina
siri
jeme nipo na lima
siri
basi na we usifiche ma
siri
sema watupishe na
siri
piche piche fuatapishe ma
siri
penzile tulisishe ma
siri
ino wewe
Nitese moyoni
That was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Salim, producer Saida Hamdun, we thank you for joining us tonight and join us tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Impuga.